previous rounds. A shift in the nature of intergenerational transfer, a dramatic shift in identity, and a generational shift. In terms of this intergenerational transfer shift, and this is quite a mouthful, what we've had in the past, and Hong Kong is not alone in this, is that older folks, the older generation, tended to transfer assets to the younger generation in terms of education and in healthcare. And in both of those transfers, there was a long payback period. What we have today is a dramatic shift in which it is the young increasingly transferring their resources to the old, doing it in the case of support for retirement, and also in the cost of geriatric care, retirement care, which, frankly, in political economic terms, and I'm a professor of political economy, has no payback. The identity shift, what we're seeing is from people describing themselves as a Hong Kong person to describing themselves as Chinese or Chinese Hong Konger, and there are some amazing differences in different groups. For example, not a single person who called himself a student, and there were 93 of them in our sample, randomly selected, not a single student described themselves as Chinese. Not one. We've never had that before. And there is an identity shift from people saying that they're Chinese equals a patriotic or loyalist, a supporter of the Communist Party, towards Chinese meaning something closer to being a national or cultural patriot. The generational shift, I think, that we have to keep in mind is this one. This is the first generation now coming up in Hong Kong. It's been 16 years since the handover on the 1st of July this year. This is the first generation since 1841 to grow up in a Hong Kong which is part of China. Now, we've not had that since 1841, and no one is alive who was here in 1841. So we've never seen this before. In this generational shift, as I was saying, 16 years, the deadline for Occupy Central, it will be 17 years after the handover. The 2017 chief executive election will be 20 years. That's a full, official, sociological generation. The key thing we have to remember is that few people under age 30 remember pre-1997 as a lived experience. To them, it's history. And if any of you have talked to people under 30 about history, you'll find that it's a strange country that you don't recognize. The lived experience for this generation is very, very different. It's about bearing the burden of the past, and I mean that literally. And it is not a case of believing in steady progress. They have not seen that, as I will show you. They have not seen the dramatic changes many of us have lived through. This is the crucial thing to keep in mind. Now, this comes straight out of government figures. Now, if you look at 1991, this is going into the 1997 handover, and you can see that folks of working age vastly outnumbered people over 60. By 2011, people of working age still well outnumbered folks in the retirement age. But according to government forecasts, not ours, government forecasts, the current state of about 13% of the population being over 60 will double to more than 26% of the population by 2031. Now that's just two more census, the one census and the following census. 2031 is the following census. And effectively what happens is that bottom 2011 pyramid, if you invert it, you get pretty close to what it's going to look like in 2031. In other words, the people who are now over 60, that small proportion, relatively speaking, is going to be upside down. The portion at the bottom will be right side up, and you can see how the burden on younger and younger generations is getting larger and larger. This is having an extremely significant effect on politics in Hong Kong. This is a low birth rate, high aging rate crisis, shifting the burden of care, which is affecting families in new ways and changing their attitudes towards government and government services, we are discovering. What we're also finding is that this seems to be a key, what we call in technical terms, intervening variable. It's one we just discovered because of research work that we did earlier this year, which was part of the most comprehensive study of the last 20 years social mobility. This was sponsored by Civic Education and the Women's Foundation and is available on their websites. This is just part of it, my part, 130 pages. There's about 300 more pages in the full study. And we find that those people of the same age who have no parents have very general patterns of very different responses from people who have parents that they're assisting. And I'll give you some detail on that in just a moment. And what we're finding is that family-friendly policies are no longer parents with children. What we're talking about now is children with parents. And this is not just Hong Kong. And as I was saying, this is an intervening variable. In other words, it's something that you're unaware of until you stumble over it, which is what happened to me. Now look at folks in their 20s. This again is from census data. It's 2011 constant dollars. And what you can see is that going all the way up to 2001, both males and females in their 20s had rising incomes. After 2001, both males and females have had steadily falling incomes. That steadily falling income now is also within the context of this question that we asked, coming out of the research we did earlier. Approximately what percentage of your personal income do you contribute to your parents? And as you can see, that 20% are under, 20 to 40, 40 to 60, over 60, all up people contributing now is about 41%. A decade ago, it was 31% who gave something to their parents. By generation, you can see that half of those under age 30 are contributing to their parents. About a fourth of those under age 30 are contributing 20% and up. Okay? And this is just going to get worse, and this is an increasing burden out of lower and lower average income. I think you can begin to see why this might affect political attitudes. And it's also a hidden burden by income. Your middle income levels, 40 to 60,000 per month, is carrying the heaviest load. Majorities of people earning between $40,000 and $60,000 per month, majorities, are giving something to their parents. Okay? And according to John Zhang, 10 years from now, he has questions about whether the government can assist as much as it's assisting now. Now, the effects of these shifts on identity. Again, this is the first post-1997, post-1841 generation. It's the first time we had almost as many people under age 30 as people over age 60 in our sample. First time. And when we ask people, how would you describe yourself by occupation, please note, please note, no student chose Chinese ID, not a one. Now this is quite a contrast to the administrative and managerial, which is business dominated, housewives and retirees. If there, the generation gap in Hong Kong has never been larger. You can also see the effects on identity tracked back to the early 1990s. Going into 1997, there was some fluctuation of responses on identity. We achieved a pattern that retained for a long period of time. It was affected by the 2008 Olympics, seemed to go back to, quote, normal, but then something has been going on over the last 18 months or so which is having a dramatic impact on how people describe themselves and think of themselves. And as you can see that there, the results on that chart, I think, quite clear. This is the breakdown by birthplace. Again, this is to emphasize the generation gap. Folks in their 70s and 80s, the majority were born in mainland China. Folks in their teens, it's a tiny minority. And this is showing up when you break out this identity by generation. People in their 18s to 29, now again, this includes students and non-students. Non-students chose Chinese as an identity, not students. Students under age 30, none. Other people who were not students, few. And you can see that, that the 18 to 29 age group has an extremely different pattern from the 60 to 85 age group. And it happens to be that most of our decision makers are in the 60 to 85 zone. We had a follow-up question where we asked, after the identity question, which of these do you consider the most important to you personally to see protected and promoted? They had these choices: China's historical and cultural identity, Hong Kong's identity as pluralistic and international, China's identity as ruled by the Chinese Communist Party, and don't know. And you can see the difference from a year ago, an increased proportion who choose the CCP identity, and the don't know identity, a drop in the Hong Kong as an international and pluralistic, about the same in terms of China's historical and cultural. And by generation, you can see some big differences as well. Hong Kong's ID as pluralistic is much taller in that decision-making group, folks in their 60s and above, than it is in the younger age group, which is partially why we're getting some of the very interesting movements that are going on right now about Hong Kong identity among younger people. You can also see some differences, if not as dramatic, in terms of responses to this question, which is another related question to nationalism by generation, not quite as dramatic. And then shift it around in terms of how people describe themselves, those feelings, you do see a difference. So that the Hong Kong person identity is distinctly less proud and excited, but so is the Chinese Hong Konger identity, which is a new identity that really started showing up about 2 years ago. It's much more critical of China than Chinese or Hong Kong Chinese identity. Now, this is having, particularly the generational shift, on political identity. This is the question we ask: which parties protect your interests best or represent you best? And when you look by age, notice the teenagers. The teenagers are significantly more likely to name a party as best representing them or protecting their interests, far more than any other decade group. This is the overall proportion of the whole sample. If you take the none out, what you get is about a 60-40 split, which we see typically in our elections. 60% pro-democracy, 40% pro-establishment. It's clear, basically, that this ratio is in a process of change among the generation now entering voting age. For the establishment, that means demographics are running against the establishment parties. This is similar to what's happening to the Republicans in the United States. So stalling reform does not improve their position. We're finding that youth are stressed, increasingly stressed, highly volatile, and so this is where we come out for the first time with recommendations for action, and we've also proposed some follow-up research to be done to get into some of these issues. That are stressing people that seemingly have little or nothing to do with politics per se, but which are being expressed in politics. So you can see, for example, bi-generational group, satisfaction with the performance of CY Leung is much less among people under age 30 than it is people 60 to 85. When you break it down by decadal groups, it's even more dramatic. Again, the teenagers are on a warpath. And in fact, by decade, it's a very strong regression line. Okay? The older you get, the less dissatisfied you are. Again, the generation gap is bigger than we've ever seen. We ask a bank of questions about how much people believe Chief Executive Ng has, and there are various things here. I want to basically focus on just one of these. This one, because of the national education issue. And you can see again, the people under 30 are distinctly different in their attitudes from folks over 60. And a second one about implementing a fair system of nomination and direct election. Again, not quite as pronounced, but it's still there. A difference between the youngest generation and the oldest generation. We had another bank of questions about how much people trust. Now, this is different from believing, but trust. Okay, trust and belief are tough things to get at, so we came at them two different ways. And I want to single out one particular issue here. People like yourself. And again, this is by generational breakdown, and this is the strongest correlation. It is by generation. And again, you can see a distinct difference between the responses of the oldest generation and the youngest generation. And here is that intervening variable stuck in. And this is where you see some really interesting responses. As the amount goes up in support, the level of distrust, no trust, goes up. And it shows up in a variety of things, asking about satisfaction and dissatisfaction, about a number of these other questions that we ask. Increasingly, when you break it down by parental support, you find that that variable shows up, and in fact, it shows up more often than any other variable, showing an association with the results. Again, and again, and again, and again, and again. Now, notice this is another bank of questions about what people are worried about, and what you find is the questions beginning from young graduates, employment situation, these are more sociological type questions, and these have larger levels of worry than the other questions, some of which are very political. Young employment graduates, aging population, mainland tourists, corruption of mainland government officials, air, water pollution, growing wealth gap, high housing prices. And it's a distinct difference between those questions and the others. When we ask this question, which is open-ended, and reclassify, you can see an overwhelming response to housing prices and poverty. Much less on political and system. Now, there are some variances that are really interesting. Notice that people who work for the civil service or in the public sector, their responses about system reform are larger than any other group. So the people who actually are administering the system are quite aware that the problem of these other problems are somehow rooted in the decision-making processes that we call the system. The political system makes the decisions on policy that affects these areas of housing and poverty. Now, system reform, it's more than economics and elections, we'll give you that. Experts basically agree on these points about what reform has to achieve. Effective shareholder input, these are technical terms for social scientists, more widely owned decisions and decision-making processes. Let me just back up just a moment on that one. In the last election, in the traditional functional constituencies, 30 functional constituencies, not a single woman was elected. Now, this is the first time we've never had a woman elected in any of the traditional functional constituencies. Zero. We also find that women are more dissatisfied about things. not because they are women, but because they are discriminated against. Because they are also, we think, we want to do follow-up research on this, carrying more of a caregiving burden, though there's no difference in terms of men and women in giving a portion of the salary to the parents. But my suspicion, and we're trying to find new research on this, my suspicion deeply is that women spend more time with children and elderly parents than men. We don't know that for a fact. Don't quote me. We want to find out if that's the case. Every woman I talk to says that's true. That doesn't mean that it is true. But that's what I'm told. And my wife tells me that. Over and over again. All right. Efficient implementation of decisions followed by evaluation and independent monitoring, which is subject to review and public feedback. These are key critical elements of reform. So we're not just talking about elections. And in this study, there are many questions that go into more detail than just elections. So we're looking, the questions we asked were focused on more effective input, legitimating outcomes, effectuating implementation and monitoring governance. Again, this is jargon, but that's what we were looking at in terms of formatting or formulating our questions in our instrument. We have never found such a high level of support and such a strength, notice the strongly support, directly electing the chief executive. So there is overwhelming support for directly electing the chief executive. There is the highest level of support we've ever polled for over the last 10 years for directly electing all LegCo seats. Again, notice the highest level of strongly support directly electing the chief executive and all members of LegCo. The strongly supported element has gone up, so the intensity has increased as well. Now, this is a summary table. There is a one-page sheet around that has this, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this. I am going to spend more time on some of the key elements selected. So, for example, this is a comparison between last year and this year about keeping the CE election committee at 1,200 members as present, just simply doing what some people say they should do. Please note, the level of support has gone down. The don't knows have gone up. The level of opposition has not changed that much, but is down slightly. The intensity has gone up some. Reforming the functional constituencies by eliminating corporate voting and equalizing, you'll find that support has somewhat gone down for this from last year. Again, more into the don't knows. Keeping the CE at the present level. Again, a very similar pattern. Abolish the FCs for LegCo, but keep them for the CE nominating committee. You'll notice that opposition has actually increased on this one and support has dropped considerably. Okay, this, so where you do see change, it's very interesting. Abolishing the FCs completely, opposition to that has actually diminished. Support has stayed about the same. In fact, exactly the same. Abolishing all of them, we phrased it somewhat differently, and you'll see that support for abolishing them is far greater than opposition to abolishing them. Proportionately. Same thing for the traditional small circle 30 FC seats. We've got it by gender in the report. Replacing them with 30 more seats. In fact, this is the most popular one by far. The compromise in the last round of reform, which was to bring in the super seats for the district councils, is actually the most popular reform. When you take the don't knows out, it's well up into the 80-something percent that support this option. Abolishing the split voting system. Again, support is far larger than opposition. Pretty good size don't know, because a lot of people don't know much about this particular issue. We tried the idea of a minimum required percentage to deal with some of the splintering effect that we're having in LegCo, where we have increasingly polarized minorities doing things like the filibuster. And there is very large support, much larger support, to have a threshold than there is opposition to it. And what's very, very interesting here again, and what's really interesting is where you do see significant changes a year on, in this area about the CE being allowed to be members of a party. That has gone up where now we have a clear majority supporting this idea of the CE being members of a party, and by party affiliation or party orientation, there's no difference. All the different groups who say a party represents them or doesn't represent them or says don't know whether it represents them or not, there's no difference. Okay, this is pretty much a consensus of a majority in all categories, all parties, all groups, that the CE should be allowed to be a member of a party. By those people who say a different party represents them, notice something really interesting here. When you look at this result, you'll notice the DAB is the only group that people who say the DAB best represents them say they have a great deal or some belief that he will implement a fair system. The Democratic Party, about this much. But notice the allies of the DAB. The allies of the DAB actually have a smaller proportion who have a great deal or some trust than the Democratic Party, and certainly than the DAB. So the so-called establishment, the FTU, the Federation of Trade Unions, is part of the establishment, as is the Liberal and NPP, New People's Party. These guys are closer together than the FTU. The FTU is actually, possibly, as distrusting, almost, as people who say the Democratic Party. And what we find also by groups, there is rather overwhelming of support. Interestingly enough, it's the FTU folks who least support the idea of direct election of chief executive. Notice that that's still 75% who support it, even among FTU members. Same thing here about all members of LegCo. And for those who are in the pro-democracy group, it's people who are oriented towards the Democratic Party who are the most enthusiastic about this. I know I have some friends who were or are in the Civic Party, but people oriented towards the Democratic Party are more committed to this than you are. And notice also about support for abolishing the FCs completely in all forms. And again, the Democratic Party leads all other groups, including the Labor, People Power, LSD, clump. And keeping them for the FC elections, the only group that has a majority wanting to keep them for the CE election is the FTU-oriented folks. Interesting group. Bi-party in terms of this issue, keeping it the same way as the nominating committee, no change. Notice that the DAB and FTU here have majorities in support, but no other group, except maybe the Liberals and NPP, they're right on the line, shows a majority in support of this. This is where we come to the concluding part, dealing with this question about fairness in policymaking. And this again is where most of the parties, except the DAB, agree that policy is made unfairly. And even the DAB, which is the core of the pro-establishment group, is split equally, 50-50, about fairness and unfairness of policymaking. And they arguably have the most influence of any group outside the chief executive himself. By generation, you can see that there is more consensus, at least among people under age 60, than there is difference. There is, again, the difference between 60 and 85 and the other generations on this issue. But still, more 60 to 85 say it's unfair than fair. And this is the most interesting one of all. When you ask this question and break it down by work sector, notice those who say they work for the civil service have the highest proportion who say it's very unfair. Those who are in the public sector have the next highest portion. In other words, the people who are actually part of the policy-making process, who actually work for it, who are implementing, they're the ones who are the most aware and most convinced that it's unfair. This gives you the wrap up here, and I'll just use this as a splash sheet.
Thank you very much. Fascinating. Before we open the Q&A, can I just ask you to explain one terminology? Mm-hmm. Chinese Hong Kongers versus Hong Kong Chinese.
What happened, we didn't have Chinese Hong Kongers in our list. We had the list with all the other options. And then what happened was just all of a sudden, 26% of our sample, when we said other, gave us this new term, Chinese Hong Kong. So we thought, well, maybe that was a one-time thing. So the next time we asked the survey, where we got almost exactly the same proportion, we said the same thing. So then we stuck it into the set of questions to ask, and we got 28%, which was statistically about the same. So this, we've done some follow-up focus groups on it. We're not totally sure because the people who choose it over others are not totally sure. They tend to be younger, but not exclusively so. They seem to lean more towards the nationalist, patriotic, cultural, you know, that's the thing they value the highest. But again, not exclusively so. They certainly seem to be more critical of the Chinese government than Chinese alone. But even that's changing now. And one of the problems with answering your question is that the fluctuations in identity are fluctuating these kinds of response patterns as well. There is definitely something happening with identity in Hong Kong, and I think anybody who's kept up with the arguments about June 4 and, you know, the boycotts that are going on for different reasons is aware that something very interesting is going on related to Hong Kong versus China. Okay, and we're picking it up also in our data.
Can you hold the mic, please?
Paul Zimmerman. I'm trying to understand the difference between electing all FC's 35 super seats on one hand being very high support, and then the other hand is abolishing Let's Go FC's and keeping the C nominating committee.
Keep four.
It's very, can you elaborate on the difference between there, because between the 88 and the 39, it seems almost a similar question, but very opposite response, or maybe I misread it. The other thing is, this support for the super seats, expanding the super seat, is this almost like a vindication and a support for the Democratic Party move? To have that, you know, the seeing is believing. We set such a high don't know on all the specific questions that people don't understand because they haven't seen it, they don't understand it.
Yeah.
But the
yeah.
one that they seem to understand, the super seat, now they have seen it, they really want it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair interpretation of that. What you have in that bottom panel is the exact phrasing in English that we asked, and you can ask completely what the Chinese was, if they'll let you know. Effectively, I think that's right. There's unless people have something to compare with or experience, we tend to get a lot higher don't knows. Once they see something that seems to be new, they go for it. Now, there's a lot of people who are arguing that we shouldn't propose big changes in our system because of exactly that kind of response, that we should try to get something more familiar than less familiar with most people. But what we find is that actually, this particular super seats was something that I argued strongly for, because an at-large election would tend to be more representative. And what we got was 40% votes for women and 60% votes for men, effectively, is how it turned out. So it's the most gender equal part of the entire legislative council. And that has tended to satisfy a lot of people. Like I say, none of the 30 traditional functional constituency seats are occupied by women. We find, in fact, that women who are getting higher education, higher educated, are participating less in the professional and business groups that are voters in the current FC system. I think that's because women are carrying more of the caring burden, and so they are
are able to be less involved in the political structures and business structures. It's not a glass ceiling, it's a caring ceiling that's affecting it. But women are aware of this, and I think they're increasingly aware that men are making decisions about policy that affects them, and they're just not able, they're simply not able to do much about it, okay, and want changes in it. So we're seeing a distinct gender difference in these responses as well. And that's one reason why this thing is so long, because it includes all of those aspects that showed an association, and we've never had so many questions so strongly associated and correlated with each other.
Michael, one quick question about school curriculum, which last year was a big issue. Any of your questions?
In the previous survey, we asked about that. The last report we made, it's on our website at hktp.org. It's on there. We asked a whole bank about national education and so forth. This time, this seems to show up when we ask, for example, about identity. We find that none, literally none of the students say they're Chinese. Not one, which has never happened before. I've never seen it before. Like I say, 93 out of 920 people who said they were students. And statistically, that's a highly unlikely result. So obviously, there's been a deep impact on students, particularly. And of course, we know this movement was really student-led and student-driven, despite conspiracy theories that there was some black hand someplace manipulating it. This is the kids, people, and they're different.
Okay, my name is Florence Changer. I report for Le Monde. I wanted to ask you about the autonomy movement, which is, I don't know if it's a movement, but the idea which is being talked about. Do you see hints in your all these numbers, and which one?
In what form of identity?
The autonomy.
Oh, autonomy. No, we didn't ask specifically about autonomy per se. We had that one question about protecting the identity of Hong Kong. We had a whole section on this on the full report. Off the top of my head, I can't tell you in detail. But if you ask Quiki, give her your email address, she'll send you the PDF file, and just click under the table of contents, and you'll find it. It's about a 5 or 6 page table of contents that goes into great detail. You'll find the breakdown there. I have to go looking it up. It's just, even for me, that's a little too many numbers. So, sorry. There is an answer. It's in there. I just can't recall the number right off the top of my head.
Next question.
I mean, by the way, that's the research done this semester, and I've got another 150-page report coming out at the end of this month. So I've got a hell of a lot of numbers in my head about many things. Energy, press, women.
Thanks for the speech. I have one question for your research. So in your research, do you allow the space for the multi-identities? Because seen from the similar survey done by the American Affairs Council of Taiwan, there are three categories, Taiwanese, Chinese, and both. I know you have two categories, Chinese Hong Kongers or Hong Kong Chinese, but that's different from those who identify themselves with both Chinese and Hong Kong. So that's my question for you all.
Yeah, there are different banks of questions that are asked, okay? The way we ask it is the way we have been asking it, and it's based on, originally before we had the Chinese Hong Konger, all of that was based on historical responses. In other words, these are categories that people have described themselves in the newspapers and in the literature for decades. We don't use the term, like Robert Chung, we don't use the term, you know, Hong Kong citizen, which is kind of a weird term. It doesn't show up until he started putting it in. I've been really reluctant to do anything about that. I think there's something wrong with it, okay? So we don't use it, so I can't comment on other people's stuff where they say both this and that, or half-half. I have no idea what that means. Ask them. I know what mine means historically. And one thing we are finding is this new kind of identity and these fluctuations do seem to have significance because we see changes in behavior. For example, the boycott of the June 4th. Okay, and this Hong Kong economy movement and this new groups forming. Okay, so our categories seem to correlate to actual events, occurrences. Okay. Which it should. You know, if you study social science in theory, if you've got your categories right, your instrument is doing the right things, you should see correlation with behavior. We do. We see that. I don't know if Robert sees that or not yet.
Well, I'm struck by, Jim Seymour, he's here. I'm struck by, as you were, that no students understand that.
And yes, it's mine.
I would ask that question. I might interpret it in two different ways. It might be, are you willing, or do you want to define yourself in terms of race? And maybe some students said, I just don't want to define myself that way. So I'm not going to pick that answer. Another quite different interpretation would be, because if you read a newspaper or listen to diplomats, and they'll say, China this, China that, China opposes such and such, China supports such and such. And by China, people who write and speak that way mean the Beijing regime, the Chinese Communist Party. And these students have been exposed to a lot of the use of the word China in that manner. And so when they say, I'm not Chinese, maybe that's what they have in mind. Those two explanations are not mutually exclusive, but I wonder which one you think is more right.
It's hard to say right now. I mean, on the one hand, I need more research, and on the other hand, I'm absolutely convinced that we're seeing great fluctuation going on. People are changing their minds, and changing what they mean, and changing maybe the same term and giving a different meaning. Like I say, we have a new generation coming up in which pre-1997 was history. And they're interpreting it very differently. And their experience of the past, which is really their aging parents, is very different from folks our age looking back and saying, wow, China, main China, has changed so dramatically, you know, that we have more hope for progress and change. But people who've seen a 10% cut in salary over the last decade and an increase in burden care, they're going to see the world differently. They do see the world differently. They are seeing the world differently. And that's changing under our feet as we talk. It's obviously, over the last 18 months, been dramatically shifting. And among students who are the group that socializes, and they're in the socialization process, again, a technical term of social science, they're the ones that are most sensitive to these system questions that you bring up. And so, yeah, I think they're definitely reacting, but I think it's going to be a moving target. And we certainly have to research it more, but also track it, because it is changing. So I think an answer now could be very different in 12 months or 16 months, or by the time we actually have a chief executive election in 2017, or actually have the votes on the reform package.
Tony Watson, an advisor to Hong Kong. Two questions, pretty brief answers. Number one, is it possible that different people, different groups have different ideas about what constitutes direct election? You see, I'm thinking of your table there, and you have surprisingly high response. And just from my reading the news, there's very wide perceptions of what constitutes direct election. Second question, at these protests that were over the last year, we see groups of people, particularly young people, carrying floating over flags. Could you just give us your 2 cents worth on that? Thanks.
Okay, first question, yes. Second question, because they're interpreting the flags of the colonial era very differently. Most of the folks carrying those flags were too young to remember what it actually meant. And to them, it doesn't mean subjugation, but it meant
more closely a time when Hong Kong identity, as they understand it, was stronger, as they see it, was stronger. Okay. That somehow the British left the Hong Kong Chinese alone. And mainland China refuses to leave the Hong Kong Chinese alone. And in fact, if you go back and you look at the colonial legacy in a more objective manner, you can see that that's pretty accurate. The government, as much as possible, left Hong Kong Chinese to take care of themselves. That's why you get the Tong Wah Group of hospitals and all kinds of charitable associations. And in fact, Hong Kong's very vigorous civil society grew up because Hong Kong Chinese organized themselves to take care of themselves, because the government wasn't doing it. In fact, we don't see the government actually even acting much at all until the 1950s, and that was only after the disastrous fires that burned thousands of people out of their homes. And that's when you begin to see this shift taking place. So objectively, we can see it one way. Subjectively, I think it's not the end.
So that's all we've got time for. Our next event is on the 13th of June. It's well-known author Joe Studwell coming to the club to talk about how Asia works, success and failure in the world's most dynamic region. Thank you again, Professor Goyer, for this really